So tonight we're going to start with a discussion of theory, and then we're going to have a discussion of the experiment, okay? And then we're going to have time for questions, and you can ask us anything you want about the discovery of the Higgs boson, okay? So we're going to start with Professor Jesse Thaler, who's a theorist. I'm a theorist, so the theorists get the floor first. The experimentalists get the last word, and he's going to tell you a little bit about what the Higgs boson is.
Great, well, thank you very much. Well, it's really wonderful to see all you here today to have a Higgs-like celebration. The Higgs boson I've listed as the triumph of the Standard Model. It's really a triumph of both theory and experiment, as Eddie said, and you'll get to hear from my colleague Marcus Klute, who's going to tell you the important role that MIT has played in the actual discovery of this particle. But all of us in particle physics are celebrating. We're not celebrating the lack of connection between... Victoria might have to help me out with getting this thing to move. Should I just riff? Ah, excellent. So we're all celebrating this Higgs-like discovery. So I'm not sure where you were on July 4th, 2012. I was in rural Virginia at a bed and breakfast with no Wi-Fi. So I was holding my cell phone to the sky trying to figure out whether we've actually discovered the particle. And once I saw it was discovered, kind of scrolling down furiously to figure out what the mass of this particle was. This discovery culminates a century of particle physics, and I'll tell you a little bit about the history of the Higgs boson in this talk. For my own research, the Higgs is important because it's likely to define the next 25 years of fundamental physics. We'll talk a little bit about that during Q&A. During this talk, you're going to see two symbols here. The MIT symbol will tell you about people in this story who were affiliated either in the past or currently with MIT. And then I'm teaching recitation for 805. Thank you. Which is the second semester of quantum mechanics. And this story has a lot to do with quantum mechanics. So little shout outs to my recitation students will be in orange font, hopefully readable as we go forward. Okay, so as a theoretical physicist, I like to take a big view of the universe. The universe is a big place, both in overall spatial extent, 10 to the 26 meters in size, but also in the hierarchies of scales that we see in nature. The universe itself, galaxies, solar systems, planets, us, our molecules, electrons, protons, the TeV scale, that's where the Large Hadron Collider is operating, going all the way down to the scale of quantum gravity. And what's really amazing about the scales that we see in nature, one is just its overall vastness, but also how much of it we in principle understand via the Standard Model of particle physics. So am I supposed to, oh, it does work, okay. The Standard Model of particle physics. The Standard Model is the four fundamental forces of nature, gravity, electromagnetism, the strong force, and the weak force. These forces, these fundamental forces, interacting with the matter constituents, the quarks and leptons of the Standard Model. Now, we've learned a lot about these forces. We know that these forces are mediated by particles. So gravity is mediated by the graviton. Electromagnetism is mediated by the photon. The strong force is mediated by the gluon. And the weak interaction is mediated by W and Z bosons. And what we're celebrating today is the last missing ingredient in the Standard Model, the Higgs boson, which now pushes our understanding of fundamental physics just a little bit further, but as you'll see, will play an even more key role in the theoretical story coming up ahead. Now, I've highlighted the weak interaction here in orange, because actually the story of the Higgs boson, it's really the story of the weak interaction. And I bet most of you don't really know what the weak interaction is. I mean, I think you know what gravity is. You know, we're very grounded here. I think you know what electromagnetism is. That's what binds electrons to nuclei to form atoms. You probably have a vague sense of what the strong interaction is. This is the interaction that actually takes quarks and pushes them together to form nucleons like protons and neutrons and then ultimately into nuclei. But the weak interaction, this is kind of the unsung hero of the Standard Model, one of the most important forces, but the one that you hear the least about. So what is the weak interaction? Well, the weak interaction does something that none of the other forces are able to do. So if you look at electromagnetic forces, and you bounce an electron off a proton, The proton is unchanged in that process, and this is the reason why you have atoms that have an electron orbiting around a proton. But the weak force is different. The weak force can perform alchemy. I can actually move myself around the periodic table. If I were to bounce electrons into protons, they can turn into neutrons. I can change the chemical structure of materials, and then I get neutrinos coming out the other side. So this isn't necessarily the most useful form of alchemy. So if I have a block of gold, I can fire electrons at it and move down to the periodic table to get platinum. So it's not necessarily the most cost-efficient way of making precious metals. But this alchemy is essential for something that we care near and dear to our heart, stellar burning. If I take two protons, slam them together, via the weak interaction, one of the protons can turn into a neutron, forming a deuteron bound state, and then you're off to the races and the sun can burn and the other fundamental forces take over. But the weak interaction is kind of the key interaction to allow for this important first step in the solar fusion cycle. Now, the weak interaction is weird, beyond just the fact that it is able to perform alchemy, and this weirdness is actually related to the Higgs boson. So let me tell you three weird things about the weak interaction. The first weird thing is that it has a massive force carrier. So unlike electromagnetism, which we know is mediated by photons, the photons are massless particles. They're able to communicate long-range interactions. And these massless photons come in two types, two polarizations. And if you've been to the 3D movies, you know this. You have one screen, and you have funny glasses, and left polarized light goes into your left eye, right polarized light goes into your right eye, and so one screen can give you two images, and that's related to the structure of Maxwell's theory. So this is a force that you're used to, electromagnetism mediated by photons, but the weak interaction is mediated by massive particles, massive W bosons, and as my 805 students will be able to tell you in a couple weeks when we get to that part of the course, actually massive W bosons, these are massive spin one particles, and they can't just have two polarizations, they have to have a third. And this third polarization will come into this story later on. The next bizarre property of the weak interaction is that it can talk to itself. It's self-interacting. So, you know, photons, under ordinary circumstances, you fire two photons at each other, they can just pass right through. But the weak bosons are able to collide with each other, and you can actually simulate this type of collision at the Large Hadron Collider. So both this third polarization and collisions will play a role coming up later on. The last just bizarre property of the weak interaction, which is not going to play a role in the story of the Higgs boson, is that the weak interaction is parity violating, which for my 805 students says that x to minus x is not a symmetry of the weak force. This is very weird. This tells you that alchemy has a different rate if you're looking at it in a mirror. Very bizarre, very strange, very counterintuitive. This whole weak force seems just baffling. And you might ask, well, why is it so baffling? Why is the weak force so weird? Why doesn't it look like any other of the forces of nature? And the reason is because the weak force is broken. Now, that's a technical term. So in 8325 in quantum field theory, we really say the word spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this is the term we use. We say the weak force is broken. For 805 students, you can think of that weak charge is not conserved, if that helps. What I want the rest of you to think about is to think about asking an analogous question. You might ask the question, why is ice so weird compared to water? I mean, ice and water, they're made of the same basic stuff, but they have very different properties. But somehow there's a phase transition in going from water to ice, and the weirdness of ice is caused by a type of phase transition. And the weak force is weird because it has already undergone a phase transition. In fact, in the vacuum, the weak force has undergone a phase transition. And it's the Higgs boson that causes this phase transition. And so the weak force would look just like all the other forces if it weren't for this transition, and somehow understanding this transition is the mystery, the aura, if you'd like, surrounding the Higgs. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about the Higgs, but maybe just to kind of set a little bit more of the stage and to give you a more of a historical perspective, just give you a little history about the past 100 years of the weak interaction and this bizarreness that we've discovered over the past 100 years. So a little history. So the weak interaction has baffled physicists since the 1920s. Chadwick and friends were studying some of these spontaneous alchemy processes where a neutron would spontaneously convert to a proton and an electron. This is a process that we know of as radioactive beta decay. And you can look at the initial state, this neutron, figure out its energy using E equals mc squared, And you can look at the final state, this proton and electron, and you can, whoa, going back. And you can figure out its energy. And you find that energy is not conserved in the weak process. This is a very confusing fact. I mean, you know, we think of energy conservation, you know, we teach it in 801. It must be true. And here you have a fundamental physics process which seems to violate energy conservation. This is totally nuts, and the solution is also totally nuts. In the 1930s, Pauli had the spectacular idea to introduce a new particle to solve this mystery of energy conservation. Introducing a new particle whose apparent sole purpose in life was to make sure that energy was conserved. He called it the neutrino. The neutrino has essentially no mass, has no charge. You can't see it in an experiment, but you put it in the equations and, oh, yeah, energy's now conserved because it's being carried away by this extra particle. This sounds totally nuts. It was so nuts that even Fermi incorporated it into a beautiful theory, one of the most successful theories of fundamental physics, the Fermi theory of weak interactions. But you might say, well, where are these neutrinos? You just invoked a new particle to solve a problem. You know, we could try to invoke a new particle to solve the budget crisis, but it's not going to make it actually fixed. So the question is, does this thing actually exist? And indeed, it does exist. It was discovered, it took a long time, but it was discovered eventually by studying reactors by Cohen and Rhines. And in 1956, we declared that this hypothetical particle actually did correspond to a force of nature. And so the lesson that I want you to take away from this story is that new particles can be connected to deep fundamental principles. Yeah, it seems kind of strange to invoke a neutrino, this particle, you know, why should you have a new particle? But it's connected to something deeper than that. It's connected to the energy conservation, and that's something that persists now in every interaction that we see it respects energy conservation. The other lesson is you have to take the long view in particle physics, that there's a long time between a crisis and its resolution, and that will be certainly true in the case of the Higgs boson. Okay, so one more. Now, digging deeper into the structure of the weak interaction, we had more discoveries. So in 1967, Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow, Weinberg was a faculty member at MIT at the time, proposed that this interaction didn't just happen by itself, but it was actually mediated by a new force. And every force in nature has a force carrier. And so in this case, you had three new force carriers, the W minus boson, which performs this weak alchemy, the W plus, which does the reverse process, goes the other direction in the periodic table, and the Z that does something else entirely. And this, too, was also discovered, if the slide works, this, too, was also discovered in 1983 at the SPS ring at the CERN experiment. So SPS is actually the injector ring for the current Large Hadron Collider that you'll hear about in the next talk. And so this was discovered in 1983, and Nobel Prizes quickly awarded to Ruby and Vandermeer. And so now here we are, a century of studying this weak interaction, and we think that maybe we're seeing history, an idea whose origins come in 1964, 48 years later, perhaps, maybe, being discovered, this last ingredient of the Standard Model. And in Marcus's talk coming up next, we'll find out whether this really is the Higgs, have we really discovered the particle, or is it just something that maybe looks like the Higgs, an imposter of the Higgs? We'll find out more coming up next. So now I need to tell you about the Higgs. What is this Higgs? What is it doing? And there's actually two Higgses. So Higgs has an amazing publicist. He's able to get his name on all sorts of things. There's actually two things that we're celebrating with the discovery of the Higgs boson. One thing we're celebrating is the Higgs mechanism, fancy word. I told you that the weak interaction is different than the other forces because it's undergone a kind of phase transition, and the Higgs mechanism is the thing that drives that phase transition. That's the thing that breaks the weak force. And as I'll explain, it's going to give mass to all fundamental particles. In particular, it's going to give mass to this W boson. And as I told you before, because this W boson has mass, it has this extra third polarization, which we're going to have to discuss. The complement to the Higgs mechanism is the actual thing that we've discovered, the Higgs boson. This is a new spin zero particle that we think has been discovered at the LHC. And since I'm teaching quantum mechanics, this boson plays an extremely important role in ensuring the consistency of quantum mechanics. And so I want to tell you about that particle's role. And we'll see that it has to do in what happens when you bounce W bosons off each other. So I'm going to walk you through the Higgs mechanism and then tell you about the Higgs boson. So today in 2012, when we have had a long view of particle physics, we've really understood the Standard Model to death. What we say the Higgs mechanism is today in 2012 is we say this is the mechanism that gives mass to all fundamental particles. This phase transition that broke the weak force made it look really strange. It also generates mass for fundamental particles. And the amount of mass you get is related to how strongly you interact with this Higgs object. So the heavy hitters in the Standard Model, the most massive particles, the W and Z bosons, which you've already heard about, or the top quark, these are particles that get a lot of their mass from this Higgs mechanism. Photons and gluons, they have no mass, and that means they have no coupling to the Higgs. And then neutrinos have itsy-bitsy tiny couplings to the Higgs. And then ordinary matter, which is made out of electrons, up and down quarks, these things have kind of middling couplings to the Higgs. And what's relevant for the next talk is precisely this relationship between how heavy you are and how strongly you couple to the Higgs. And if you're trying to discover a Higgs boson, you want to do it via some of the heaviest particles in the Standard Model. So this Higgs mechanism, this is how we think about the Higgs in 2012. But this is not what we were thinking about in 1964. That in 1964, when Higgs came around, or rather a whole slew of people, and then Higgs's name got attached to it, so Peter Higgs calls it not the Higgs mechanism, but the Anderson-Brout-Englert-Higgs-Gerlinek-Hagen-Kibble-TUF mechanism, a series of papers that were exploring this question of how do I have a massive force? How do I have a massive force carrier? How do I have a consistent theory that takes the two polarizations of an ordinary force and tacks on a third? That's what they were worried about. They weren't really worried about masses of all the other fundamental particles. They were worried about this particular type of fundamental particle, a particle involved in communicating a force. And their theoretical triumph in 1964 was to realize that the answer was staring them in the face, that 3 years earlier, work by my colleague in the Center for Theoretical Physics, Jeffrey Goldstone, and also Yuichiro Nambu, they showed that any time you have this kind of phase transition, any time you have this kind of breaking, there's a necessary type of particle that emerges from that breaking. And we call that now a Nambu-Goldstone boson. And their realization was that if you took Jeffrey's particle, combined it with two polarizations of an ordinary force, then you would end up with three polarizations, and now you had a fully consistent way of talking about a massive force. And this was an amazing breakthrough. This opened up our eyes to the diversity of forces that you could have in nature. You no longer had to have everything look like photons. They could look hip and cool. Now, Higgs gets a little asterisk, because Higgs had one additional piece of insight, which is that there was another potential type of particle that was, at the time, maybe an optional consequence of breaking this phase transition could perhaps give rise to a Higgs boson. So Jeffrey's particle was necessary. In fact, we've already seen it. We've seen all three polarizations of the W boson. Higgs's particle, we don't know yet. We take this mechanism, and now we have the Standard Model. The birth of the Standard Model came when we realized that you could describe forces that look totally different from each other. Electromagnetism, which is mediated by a photon, it's an unbroken force, it has a massless photon, it gives long-range interactions that you learn about in 802. Comparatively, the oddball in the Standard Model, the W and Z bosons, they're broken, they're massive, they only give rise to short-range interactions. And then because we're using the Higgs mechanism, the theory that Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow wrote down in 1967 invoked, of course, the Higgs boson. Tack onto this the strong interactions described by Pulitzer, Gross, and Wilczek in 1973. Tack on gravity as described by, Newton. And there you go, you have the Standard Model of particle physics. And the Standard Model has had this ingredient, this Higgs boson, this last missing piece, in it since its inception. And the question is, did it need to be there? Was this the keystone of the Standard Model, the most important piece, the thing that held everything together? Or was it the appendix, some extra little thing that Peter Higgs wrote down that you could just slice off and the Standard Model didn't need it? And it was an interesting theoretical question. People talked about, does the Higgs exist, does it not? People wrote models where the Higgs did or did not exist. But if we appeal to quantum mechanics, we can actually see the absolute necessity of the Higgs and why this is what we think of as a theoretical triumph, an idea in 1964 that then has an actual implication in the world that we see. And this comes back to this idea of the fact that W's can interact with itself. And we can imagine what happens when you collide together weak bosons. So I told you that weak bosons can collide with each other. And as a quantum mechanic, I want to know what is the probability of when I collide these W bosons, what is the probability of something's going to happen? Quantum mechanics is a theory of probability. I don't know for certain what anything's going to be. I can only calculate the probability. I think everyone in this room would agree that there's a 100% chance that something's going to happen when you collide things. Maybe they're going to go through each other. And my 805 students, if you want to know what 100% actually means, I'm teaching 806 next semester, and I'd be happy to let you know. Okay. And so you can now calculate for the weak interaction, for this scattering, what happens when you do this collision? What happens in terms of probabilities? And you find, bizarrely, that as a function of energy, when you collide these W bosons at a scale around 1 tera electron volt, you find that probabilities shoot up. And quantum mechanics is broken. What does it even mean to have more than 100% probability of something happening? This also explains why we built the LHC where we built it. We built the LHC with a center of mass energy of 14 TeV. And we did this because we wanted to see this possibility. This would be an amazing thing if it were true. But something even more amazing happens, and that is a new fundamental particle comes to save the day. So you can actually buy your own commemorative Higgs boson online for $10.49. Add a billion to that, that's roughly the cost of the LHC. And via quantum mechanical interference, the original scattering process plus the one involving this Higgs boson conspire such that the probability is going up, 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 and then you hit the mass of maybe 125 GeV, perhaps, and you turn over and you have a perfectly smooth quantum mechanical probability. And in fact, this structure of seeing probabilities as a function of energy, you're going to see this again in the next talk. And hunting for a Higgs is really hunting for bumps of this form. And you'll be able to hunt your Higgs yourself in Marcus's talk coming up next. So this was the weak interaction, a totally bizarre force. You've probably never even thought about it. But it's connected to a profound prediction. These weird features of the weak interaction, the fact that it gives rise to alchemy, the fact that it has a massive carrier, the fact that it interacts with itself, and as I mentioned briefly, the fact that it's parity violating, completely strange. Yet these properties are connected to two deep ideas, the Higgs mechanism, the breaking of a force, a phase transition, giving mass to fundamental particles, and then a new particle to discover, the Higgs boson, a particle that, luckily for 805, makes sure that quantum mechanics is perfectly safe. So I want to conclude just by showing you the picture that I gave before of all the scales in nature and the triumph over the past 100 years to explain an amazing vastness of properties via just four fundamental forces plus the Higgs. What you've seen in this talk is that new particles, they're not just new particles that you discover. They're things that are connected to deep fundamental principles. We saw that the neutrino was connected to energy conservation, the W and Z bosons, they're really just like all the other forces, just in a different phase. They emphasize that basically all forces are essentially similar. And then this Higgs boson, which tells us that probability is conserved and we can do quantum mechanics. And part of my optimism about the future of fundamental physics is that the research that I do is at the boundaries of the Standard Model. And why I think there's an exciting future is that there are new particles waiting to be discovered, perhaps new particles related to dark matter or other things. And fundamental principles that we have in our theorist head that have yet not been verified, ideas like supersymmetry that you can ask me about during Q&A. And the fact we have this mismatch and the fact that we still have these open questions means that there is perhaps something even beyond the Higgs that extends our horizons for fundamental physics. So with that, because this is all about the Higgs today, we're going to postpone a discussion of the future of physics and talk about the present, the amazing discoveries by my colleague and his collaborators at the LHC experiment to actually discover this Higgs boson. Thank you very much.
Okay, so now we're going to have a talk by Professor Marcus Klute. And he's an experimentalist. He works at CERN. He also works at MIT, so he commutes. And he's here today. And we'll take questions afterwards, okay? So, oh, I have to find this up.
It's somebody putting up the slides? Or do I do this? All right, so I can start without the slides, maybe. So thank you, Jesse, for setting the stage. And thank you all for coming tonight to celebrate the discovery of a new particle with us. And now I need a slide. That is the last slide. I want the first slide. OK. So this is what we're going to talk about. All right, so let's start with this slide. So we made a discovery this summer. We found a new particle. And the big question is if this particle, as Jesse alluded to, is the last and final piece of the puzzle, or maybe just another piece of a puzzle which is bigger than the standard model we know today. So what I'm going to try to do in the next 20, 25 minutes is to explain to you what it takes to generate Higgs bosons and to detect them with the experiments we built over the last years, and then show you how we try to... Can you hear me in the back? Thumbs up, very good. Okay, I don't have any control here, it's interesting. On the previous slide I was about to say. Okay, so what's happening here? Fine. That doesn't work. Okay. Good. So what I'm trying to do with this presentation, first of all, I try to get it under control somehow. But then I'm trying to explain how we produce Higgs bosons and how we try to establish them as being Higgs bosons, or maybe try to probe and find out that we actually found something which is inconsistent with the expectation, which is the standard model Higgs boson. What am I supposed to do? So when you're hunting for the Higgs boson and you're searching for this new particle, you don't take a rifle. You take a powerful accelerator, a machine which accelerates protons to extremely high energies. And then on the next slide, okay. I just wait for this to be resolved.
Yeah, sorry. Look, it works in theory. Come on.
Yeah, so. What? Why don't you just go ahead and come and just say next when you want to.
Yeah, but she's already had a few slides, so I need to go back.
You want to go, where do you want to go to?
I want to go back to the second.
You want to go back to the second
yeah.
slide? So this one?
Yeah.
Or you want to stay here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Oh, one more.
One more?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So should I just say next?
Yeah. Just finish the slide. We should have it up by then.
All right. Okay. I think we almost have it under control now. I said that you need this powerful accelerator. You need a detector or detectors in order to look, photograph events which might give you some indication of the particles you created and the signatures you're looking for. You need extremely powerful computing. A computing system which is able to deal with a vast amount of data. We're talking not about gigabytes or terabytes. We talk about multiple tens of petabytes of data being generated by those experiments. And you need people. You need thousands of scientists, engineers, postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduate students in order to, you know, build, to operate this really complex machinery and to extract the physics, which is what we did last summer successfully by finding the Higgs boson. Next. So the experimental approach is here, we collide protons and protons at very high energies, and then we look at the resulting particles which come out of those interactions. And we measure precisely what their momentum is, what their direction is, and also we are able to identify different types of particles. So we go to high energies, which allow us to, in some sense, look deep into the matter which we collide, in this case, protons. We go to high energies also because this allows us, next, to create new particles, according to Einstein, E equal mc square, providing a lot of energy in a collision allows us to create very heavy particles, and the Higgs boson is a heavy particle. And we are able to probe the early universe because by providing a lot of energy in a confined space is equivalent to providing a very hot and condensed matter. Next. So all of this we do in a very controlled environment of the laboratory. Next. Okay, it's very confusing. Okay. We saw the timeline of this theoretical developments, and Jesse alluded to the fact that during this timeline there were discoveries of new particles which confirmed the theory. I can turn this around as an experimentalist and say a lot of progress has been made in the field through the developments and achievements in the tools we use in order to do our physics. And one of the tools we use are accelerators. And so you see here, as a function of time, for the last 40 or 50 years, the achievements which have been made on a logarithmic scale in the energy being available in collisions in a set of accelerators. And we distinguish between two classes of accelerators, one where we collide fundamental particles, electrons and positrons, where the entire collision energy is available to us, or where we take more complex sources like a proton, where in a collision of a proton with another proton, we're actually studying the collision of the constituents of the protons, which are quarks and gluons. So those typically don't carry the full energy of the proton, so that kind of reduces the total energy available in our collision. So you see this fast rise in available collision energy, and at the top of this is the LHC. So this is a new tool, the new kid on the block, which allows us to probe, to really have the highest energies available to look for new matter and to discover the Higgs boson. Next slide. The Large Hadron Collider is this proton-proton machine, and it has been built to collide protons and protons at 14 TeV. Currently, we operate at a slightly lower energy. So this is located in a beautiful setting. You see the French Alps on one side, and on the lower side, the Jura Mountains, and this is located very close to the city of Geneva and the Lake Geneva. A beautiful area, and you see this ring here, when you actually fly into Geneva, which I do on a very regular basis, you don't see the ring. The ring, the collider, is actually based 100 meter, 50 to 175 meter under the surface. Next slide. So we have a couple of experiments which, you know, probe those collisions, and the two which are relevant for the discovery of the Higgs bosons are the CMS and ATLAS experiment. So to give you a few facts about the LHC, this ring, this collider, has a circular tunnel of 27 kilometers. We accelerate those protons to 4 tera electron volts, and each beam of protons consists of 1,400 buckets of protons, each consisting of 10 to the 11 protons. So you see that we take those buckets and have them run around in a circle and bring them to collision at a well-defined set of points. Those buckets then collide, and most of the protons, they don't see each other. They just go through each other. But still, since we have so many protons, there is regularly in the order of 30 collisions every 50 nanoseconds. This corresponds to a rate of 20 megahertz of actually collision events, which we want to analyze. So our detectors are built to already probe if the event might be of interest to us, such that we don't have to analyze every single boring event. And so we reduce this rate from 20 megahertz to 300 hertz in those collisions. So I said already that the collisions of protons are actually collisions of the part of the constituents of the protons, the quarks and the gluons. And so what we're actually up to is trying to look into the decay products, the resulting particles in this collision. Next slide. The apparatus, basically our camera, which we use in order to look at those collisions. Here, this is showing the CMS detector, enormous devices. To give you a scale again, the diameter of the CMS detector is 15 meters, or 50 feet, and has a length of 30 meters, or about 100 feet, and weighs 14,000 tons. 14,000 tons is heavier than the Eiffel Tower, which is an enormous building. And interesting enough, if you wrap this up, this detector, my colleague Christoph Post pointed this out to me on the previous slide again. If you wrap this up in foil, it actually still swims in water. But it is a very compact and interesting device. On the next slide, yes, this is a good slide. We use different technologies in order to look at the detector. And we do this in order to measure, again, the momentum and the energy and the identity of the particles being created here. We do this with a silicon strip detector with very heavy material in order to stop the particles. And here we use, for example, at CMS, a lead tungsten electromagnetic calorimeter. And all of this is equipped in a large magnetic field. We use the magnetic field in order to bend the particle, and through the bending, extract information about the momentum of the particle, something you learn in 802. Next slide. So the detector has been built over many years. This is a picture of the side of the CMS detector in the year 2000. In the year 2000, you see this building there, in which was already used in order to set up the detector. And next to the building, you see a hole. That is the hole to which we actually lowered the detector, which has been built on the surface, into the collision hall. On the next slide, you see a picture of this collision hall in 2004. Everything was still empty. About 100 meters under the surface, there is this huge collision hall, bigger than this lecture hall here, which is, you know, has been dubbed the Cathedral of Science. It was really an amazing sight. You go into this, you go down with an elevator, you go into this enormous empty area, which is nicely painted white, so you really think that you're standing in a big cathedral. Next slide. Okay, so I told you that, you know, we have this detector, we take those collisions. We do think still want to extract physics out of this collision, so we have to analyze them. So this data comes out of the detector at a rate of 300 hertz. Each event has a size of about a megabyte when it comes out of the detector. So our first task is to store and secure the data. It's a very valuable asset. And we do this, we usually make two copies of the data, one directly at CERN in Geneva, and a second copy somewhere distributed on the globe. We reconstruct our data, which means that we, you know, take the bits and bytes, the output of the detector, the actual picture being taken, and reconstruct particles, you know, electrons, muons, neutrinos as well, and other particles. We use simulation, so we make actually, we recreate the collision in the computer and simulate the entire CMS detector in its whole. And we use those simulated events and to compare them with the actual collision events, with the actual data. So all this is done in a worldwide distributed computing center. And I told you already that we are creating data volumes in the order of 20 petabytes in a single year. Next slide. And then there's the people, all the people which are needed in order to run the experiment, to build it, to set it up. You see here a picture of the woman in CMS. Which we had one day where we had the entire experiment being operated by only female people, and it worked actually quite well. overall, the CMS experiment consists about of 3,000 people. An interesting number for you, there's about 800 graduate students in the collaboration, and MIT has one of the largest university group within this collaboration. So you can say the sun never sets on CMS, and I say my inbox is never empty. People are always working at any time of the day somewhere on this globe in order to perform physics. Next slide. So the Higgs group here at CMS, you know, we have three faculty trying to, you know, work in CMS, trying to find the Higgs boson. And then there is a large... What's funny about that? So we killed one of the researchers here. He's now faculty at Northwestern University. But our work is actually based on the work of our students, of our graduate students, and also of our undergraduates. We have a large body, a little army of undergraduates who regularly work with us. Last summer, during the time of the discovery, we had 7 MIT undergraduates at CERN. I see at least one here in the audience right now. And I do think they had a lot of fun, you know, watching the events, but also participating in the research. Next slide. Okay, coming back to the physics. So we're talking about the collision of protons, and you can think about the collision of gluons and quarks. And we can illustrate this in so-called Feynman diagrams. So when we have 2 gluons interacting with each other, they cannot create directly a Higgs boson because they're massless, and Jesse tried to explain that, you know, you need massive particles in order to create Higgs bosons. But we can do this, or nature can do this, through one of those loops, through a top quark. And a top quark is a very heavy particle. And that heavy particle is able, you know, to generate, you know, this Higgs boson, which then immediately decays in our detector. So there's no way that we actually see the actual Higgs boson, but we can see the decay products of the Higgs bosons. In this diagram here, it's 2 photons. And then we can analyze those 2 photons and, for example, reconstruct the mass of the 2 photon system. And that mass then, the presence of the 2 photons and the reconstructed mass, then gives us evidence that we actually saw a Higgs boson being created in our detector. There's a number of different varieties of processes which we can cause or create Higgs boson, and then the Higgs boson decays into a number of different processes. So that, all of this is determined by the mass of the Higgs boson itself. So now that we found a new particle and we are able to measure its mass, we know how the Higgs boson has to behave, so we can turn this around and probe our data against the hypothesis that this was actually a standard model Higgs boson. On the next slide, I show you a little anecdote, which just gives you some idea on how this works, right? So we have hundreds of people trying to work and trying to discover the Higgs boson, and it's kind of like shepherding cat. And Christoph Paus, you should ask him afterward, he's coordinating this effort inside the collaboration. It's really shepherding cats and trying to get everybody to work together towards the same finish line. One of the aspects of the analysis we performed is that we don't want to bias ourselves. We don't want to create a discovery out of nothing or exclude the presence of a Higgs boson just because we are too cautious and we make a wrong decision. So what we decided is we did this data analysis without ever looking where the Higgs boson, in any signature which might be interesting or might give us indication of the presence of the Higgs boson, up to the point where we were certain that we understand the analysis to the highest possible degree. And then we opened the box. So while Jesse was holding up his phone July 4th, we had our big event already June 15th, where we opened the box and looked into our data and found that we actually had discovered a new particle. And then it took us a little bit of time to understand what we actually discovered before we went out and announced the discovery. Next slide. This is one of those events. So this is a collision event in the CMS detector. And what you see is those 2 red kind of blobs in the detector. There are indications that there is large energy depositions in the electromagnetic calorimeter. And for us, this means that there's 2 photons in the event and not much other things going on there. So we can take those 2 photons, reconstruct the mass, and then plot the mass for all events which have 2 photons. And that's shown on the next slide. And when you do that, you have other processes which contribute to the same signature. And when you then analyze this diphoton mass distribution very carefully, you find that there is a little blob. And that little blob corresponds to the particle we just discovered. So those 2 plots here shown for the CMS experiment and for the ATLAS experiment are our strongest indication that we found a new particle. So you see this axis of event over a given background, and that is the indication that there is a discovery. What you see here is that both experiments find the same axis or similar axes at the same mass, so both experiments independently found the same particle. That's quite confirming. And then we compare data we collected in 2011 with data we collected in 2012. We also see, because there's less data, less significant, but we see the same signature in the detector. So overall, we have quite strong evidence here, undisputable evidence that there is new physics in our data. And we then compare now the strength of the signal with the expectation of the standard model Higgs boson. We find that it's a little bit high. We actually find more events. ATLAS finds almost twice as many events as we would expect, and CMS 1.6. But the uncertainty on this measure is still too large to draw any conclusion of this. Next slide. So the second channel we use, the second decay channel which we use in order to, you know, get evidence for this new particle is the one where the Higgs boson actually couples to the Z boson, creates two Z bosons which then themselves decay into two leptons, electrons or muons. So you have a final state in which you have four leptons. Again, similar to the analysis I was presenting before, you are able to reconstruct the mass for this four-lepton final state. And if the mass then is consistent with your Higgs boson, we actually confirm the particle. So this is one of those events. You see an electron, a positron, and two muons. And the mass then combined for those four leptons is 126 GeV. Next slide. So this has been done by ATLAS and CMS. And here you have a much lower level of background, other processes contributing to the same final state. But you see this little axis there, both in ATLAS and CMS, again, consistent between the two experiments and consistent between the data sets taken in 2011 and 2012. The evidence is a little smaller in this channel than the previous one, but combining everything, both experiments find, that's on the next slide. No, okay. Both experiments find a significance of 5 sigma, 5 standard deviation from the hypothesis that this is background only. So this is a strong evidence. Going back. So now we want to actually figure out if this is the last puzzle piece of the puzzle, or if we found something new. And so we can compare again the expectation with the result of the measurement. And this is kind of illustrated in this complicated diagram where we try to probe directly the coupling of the Higgs boson to the particles we identify in the detector. And the coupling is related to the mass of the particles in which the Higgs boson decays. So those two concepts have to match together if this is really the standard model Higgs boson. And you see, so we measure the deviation from the standard model expectation in this diagram, and everything is more or less consistent with zero, with the standard model, with the exception of there's a little bit of tension when we look at the decay of Higgs bosons into tau leptons. So this is not significant, but intriguing. So this is something we have to investigate in the future with more data and with time to come. Next slide. So to summarize, we have observed a new particle, a new boson. That new boson has a mass, 125 GeV. Knowing the mass, we know basically everything which is which needs to be known about this particle, assuming it's a standard model Higgs, and that we turn around in order to probe it and test it. The evidence is in two channels and confirmed by the ATLAS collaboration, so both CMS and ATLAS saw this evidence. And the open question is still, is this the final missing piece or not? Next slide. So to conclude, not to summarize, but to conclude, this is the first historic discovery made by the LHT experiments. I, you know, highlight first here because I do hope that this is not the last. This was a fantastic experiment for me personally, for my MIT group, for the undergraduates who joined us over the summer, and I think a truly great moment for physics. And I do apologize for the technical problems we had initially. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, well, now Christoph Paus, whose picture you saw up there, he's going to talk for just a couple of minutes, and then we're going to have questions. So we can even turn the lights on, because I think the presentation is over, and then we'll be up here for questions, okay? So, Christoph.
So, good evening. So, I just wanted to basically add two, three words about, want to make a little bit of PR for basically working at the LHC, which I think Marcus has done, of course, very well, but I think, being confronted with an experiment who has 3,000 or maybe even more, 3,500 people working on it, I think some of the students might get a little bit kind of intimidated about the fact, what is my role going to be? And I think, the story which Marcus has told is that, our group, the MIT group, has actually made a very large impact in this analysis here in finding this new particle Higgs-like. And we had some really amazing students. They have basically changed things around for the whole collaboration. And I think, of course, it's challenging, and basically there's, I would say, some rough wind blowing towards you, but people at MIT, of course, are used to that. They drink from the fire hose, as I have seen it happen. And so I think that's a great opportunity. I also wanted to basically make the case for the comparison of the small versus the large experiment. So there is experiments which are very small. That means there's basically 5, 10 people working on them. And that's, of course, a great situation because, well, usually what that means is that you can understand very well what's happening, that basically all the details are there and you're probably going to be able to comprehend them at some point. And that's great. But if you think about it, in a small experiment, there's a small number of people. And, well, the likelihood that all of those people are really awesome, like absolutely awesome, well, it's probably not very good. I mean, it's like, well, you have a usual distribution of people. Now, right? Well, that's how it is. I mean, there's some people that are very good, and there's people who are not that good, and then there's people who are really terrible, right? So, and now when you go to a large experiment, the good thing is actually that there is very, very many people. And there's a distribution of people. And so the good thing about this is actually that you can go out and you can find the best people, the really awesome people, and you can actually compare yourself with them. You can learn from them and you can work with them. And so, well, what I wanted to say is, well, this has been an amazing experience to be actually, well, finding this particle, doing this with a huge number of people. Of course, there's also a lot of human interest stories. People, well, they're just human. I think it's a great time to join. And, well, we always take undergraduate students as much as actually we can. And so, well, if you're interested, come by, see us. And, well, I think then we go to the Q&A, I guess.
Okay, thank you. So are you going to pass around a mic? I think the students are going to help us with this. I think we could have the lights up here, too, if you want them. Okay, thanks. So, okay, we're going to take questions. And
we'll be passing the mic around, so it'll be recorded.
I have a question on the second talk about the experimental talk. Your second channel from the Higgs was a double Z, and I think I remember the mass of the Z is about 90, 91 GeV. The leptons are okay because they could have they have smaller masses if you use electrons and muons. My question is, how do you get 180 GeV from a 125? Does that mean they are virtual particles and the leptons are real or what?
Should we need a theoretical answer or an experimental answer? No, you gave the answer already. So when the Higgs boson decays, you can, for a short period of time, create a particle which is virtual. And when it then decays as well, then the mass of the reconstructed mass of one of the Z boson is, it's called off-shell. It's not as a mass, the real mass of the particle.
Okay, more questions. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, since you divided the talk between theoretical and experimental physics, and it seems like most of the discovery work has been done on the experimental side, if you could talk a little bit about the theoretical role and what's been done recently. Is it more in the future implications, or is it more in the justification for building the LHC and how they sort of complement each other?
So it wasn't like for the last 48 years we've been doing nothing in theory. So one of the things that you'd like to know to determine that this thing really is a Higgs boson is you want to know its detailed properties. And to compare an experimental result to a theoretical result, we have to do intricate calculations to figure out what this one little particle, what actually it would look like when manifested in an experiment. And so a lot of the simulations, when you're simulating data, takes theoretical calculations into account. And in fact, had we stopped doing theoretical calculations 30 years ago and we had made this discovery, then we would have erroneously concluded that this particle has nothing to do with the standard model Higgs, since theoretical calculations actually gave you factors of three corrections as you started going more accurate in your calculations. So that was one role that that theory has played.
I mean, maybe to sharpen this a little bit is the fact that when you go out and you try to find that particle, well, you have to know what you look for. Well, the experimentalist builds the experiment, but then, well, we need advice on, well, what is actually exactly that we're looking for, and then you need to know all the properties, the details to optimize the analysis. So all of the analysis are optimized, the different channels, it's clear we have to do this, we have to do that, we have to do that, and then we can optimize the analysis and get the best result. And only, well, if theorists do the calculations, we can really do that.
I'd like to say another thing about theory, which, you know, Jesse presented a model, the standard model, and we talk about it as a great triumph because we say everything works beautifully and we found the final missing piece, question mark. And the reason we say that is because there are still many things we don't understand about the standard model. Like each particle, the electron, the muon, the tau, the up quark, the down quark, the charm quark, the top quark, the bottom quark, they all have different masses, and we have no idea what sets the values of those masses. Those are input parameters. We really don't have any idea why there are four forces. There's the gravitational force, the strong force, the weak force. Does that count to four? The electromagnetic, yeah.
Electromagnetic, yeah.
So there are still real deep mysteries in our picture. And you were asking about theory, and theory is now at a very funny juncture because we have an incredibly successful theory. There are no contradictions between any of the predictions of the theory and experiment. And yet at the same time, there's something very unsatisfying about the theory because it has lots of input parameters. And everyone would like to be able to go home and calculate on a piece of paper the values of those masses for those particles, or to find relationships between them which indicate that you have a deeper understanding than what we have. So that's why there's a question mark on that final missing piece. We really don't know that this is the end of the story. It probably isn't. I would say, excuse me, I take it back. We know this is not the end of the story, but there's still plenty of room for theorists to take the next step in our understanding of the fundamental forces.
Earlier you mentioned that the Higgs boson gives mass to every elementary particle. Can you explain how that process actually occurs?
Sure. So this is one of the most confusing elements of the standard model, exactly how this mass is generated. And the mathematics of it is that there's this entity that fills all of space-time, which individual particles couple to this entity with different strengths. And that entity's sole role is to generate mass for the fundamental particles. Now, it doesn't generate mass for everything, so protons and neutrons get their mass from a completely different mechanism for mass generation. But this kind of fluid filling the universe that we call the Higgs field, this is an entity that whose strength of coupling to determines what your fundamental mass would be. I don't know if Eddie wants to...
No, I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. So Higgs really has three names. So he has the Higgs mechanism, the Higgs boson, and then this thing, the Higgs field, which permeates all of space.
So you mentioned that the experiment uses 10 to the 11 protons and 1,400 buckets. I'm curious how you generate these particles, and is the 1,400 buckets... an artifact of the way they're generated or serve some purpose in the actual experiment?
So those particles are protons, and you have protons in abundance when you have a gas bottle of hydrogen.
The only thing you have to do is strip off the electron. So that is the answer. So that's actually being done. There's a gas bottle somewhere, and you know, you start from hydrogen, you strip off the electron, or you add another electron maybe, and then you start accelerating this charged object. So that's how your protons enter the acceleration chain. There's a number of there's a longer acceleration chain which is needed in order to get that many protons in the machine and accelerate them. Didn't talk about any of the details. The SPS, which was part of the discovery of the W and Z boson, is part of the acceleration chain now. So you stepwise increase the energy of the particles. You try to keep them together in phase space, which means the energy spread of the particle has to be small, and they have to be actually very close together, such that you can, you know, control them and feed them into the next accelerator chain.
So maybe adding one little piece, which is not really super important, but I thought I'd say something. So the generating the protons is relatively straightforward because you have the hydrogen and you strip off the electron. In the previous machines, usually it was preferred to actually collide matter with antimatter, so you would have a proton and an antiproton. These machines would be easier to build because when you let them collide, the magnet, which basically keeps them on a circular track, would actually work exactly correctly for both of them if they would go have opposite charge but go in opposite direction. So they would basically actually going through the same magnet actually follow both the right track. Now with protons, that's of course more difficult because now the two particles have the same charge and they basically have to go. You have to have the magnetic field exactly flipped around so that they basically stay on the same track going opposite direction. The problem, of course, to make antiprotons, well, unfortunately, we have no anti-hydrogen. So, well, yeah, well, we have anti-hydrogen, except for not in very large quantities. So it's very easy to have hydrogen. And so the way you would get the antiproton is, of course, by having a reaction where you just scatter protons off a target and basically you produce basically one antiproton out of 1,000 of those collisions. So you need 1,000 protons to get one antiproton, which in general always was a limitation in the way proton-antiproton machines would work. So.
Okay, another question.
I had a question about the beauty quark, because I've heard about the beauty quark and I was wondering where does it fit into the standard model?
She asked about the beauty quark.
Yes.
Well, the beauty quark now is called the bottom quark. So maybe that's why you don't hear about it anymore.
That would explain things.
Yeah,
thank
because
you.
The quarks, we have the quarks have six, they're called flavors. And those are the six flavors. And the six flavors of quark are up, down, charm, strange, top, and bottom. But they used to be called truth and beauty. And I don't really know why truth and beauty went away and it became top and bottom.
It was too romantic.
It was too romantic. So yeah, I prefer truth and beauty. So there's no such thing as a beauty quark, there's only a bottom quark. And the bottom quark is a quark which weighs, I think, 5 GeV, and there are particles which contain the bottom quark which have been made, and its existence is really not in dispute because they're actually entire accelerators designed to producing bottom quarks. Can you give her the mic, please? Yes.
What do you do with the bottom quarks once you've produced them?
Well, you know, all of these, most of these particles which are made, they're very, very short-lived. So just like the Higgs boson, the lifetime of the Higgs boson must be 10 to the minus 22 seconds, something like that. It's incredibly tiny.
Yeah, but isn't it increased when you accelerate many electrons?
I'm sorry?
Isn't its life span increased when you accelerate it to those kinds of...
Oh, yes. There is a relativistic effect that if you create a particle in motion, then in its own rest frame, it has a certain lifetime, but if it was moving fast enough, it would, in our frame, live for longer. And yes, but all those kind of relativistic effects, they're very carefully taken into account when they build the accelerator. And they're very aware that the clocks on the particles run at different rates if the particles are moving. I think in the rest frame of the particles, the accelerator is probably this big because of relativistic space contraction.
So that's taken into account. And when you say, what do you do with the particle when it's made? Typically, the particle is made, it instantly decays. We look at the debris, and we reconstruct the particle from the debris. And that's what happens with the Higgs, and that was what happens with bottom quarks, too, when they're made.
So I was wondering if the Higgs boson has mass by coupling to itself, or what gives the Higgs itself mass?
You mean, obviously, you know, if the Higgs gives mass to all fundamental particles, doesn't the Higgs give mass to itself? That's the question. So that's in the context of the standard model, absolutely it does. And for me to really sign off and say that the standard model is absolutely true, I want to see the interaction that shows that the Higgs talks to itself. That is something that I know Marcus has some ideas about future opportunities to make that measurement, but that would really seal the deal for me to show that the Higgs had this kind of, yeah.
So you could measure this by looking at Higgs bosons who decay into themselves. So a Higgs boson could decay into two Higgs bosons. The problem is that you need even more energy in order to produce this first Higgs boson, which then is able to decay into two and then decays into other things. The other thing is that decays, that process is really, really rare. So there is a chance that if you run this machine for about 30 years, maybe 20, we have a chance at making this discovery. And it is a very important question. Alternatively, we could design a different machine, for example, an electron-positron collider, which runs at a slightly higher energies, slightly higher, around 800 GeV or so, higher compared to previous experiment, and then it would be possible actually to create those double Higgs boson events, which could be used in order to probe the coupling of the Higgs boson to itself. But that does cost a lot of money.
I was just wondering, so when the Higgs boson decays into various things, so it decays into leptons, but it also gives mass to leptons, why is it that when that, like, I guess what I'm asking is, do leptons make up that Higgs boson, or when it decays, does the decay actually, does it affect leptons that are around it at that point and cause that to have mass?
Do you want to try it?
Well, I think there's, maybe conceptually, it's not just one Higgs boson around there. So the Higgs is there everywhere and all the time. It's like there's not just one electron, right? There's infinitely many. And the Higgs is everywhere. So that means the particular Higgs particle which has appeared and which is decaying, couples according to the rules of engagement with the Zs, according to their mass. And then basically the Z decays to the leptons. But, well, the leptons have mass, because there's the Higgs field around it everywhere, and so, there's a property of the particle. So,
let me try to help a little bit with that. You know, I think what you're thinking of is if you have an atom, you know, you see that it's made of electrons in a nucleus, and if you break it apart, out come the electron in the nucleus. So you're tempted to think that any elementary particle that decays into something, before it decayed into it, it was like a little bag containing those particles. That's your model, I think. You know, so you're saying if the Higgs can decay into an electron and an anti-electron, isn't it just a little bound electron and anti-electron? Well, it can also decay into a bottom and anti-bottom, so maybe it also would be that. It can also decay to two photons. So I think when you see that it has multiple decay channels, it's not, I would say it's probably not convenient to think of it as a bag containing those particles which existed before the decay. I would not view it that way. Yes, the coupling, he asked if we know what modulates the decay of the Higgs boson into different things. And what I would say is that the ratio of the couplings for each decay is actually exactly in the same ratio as the masses of the decay products. So it happens because the Higgs field gives mass to things. The amplitude, the quantum mechanical amplitude for the Higgs to go to bottom, anti-bottom, is divided by the amplitude to go to, let's say, electron, anti-electron, is exactly in the ratio of the mass of the bottom to the mass of the electron. So a lot of these things are very well known by the theory.
Well, let me add one more thing, because I'm not sure, maybe it's not clear to me whether this was really the answer to the question or whether this was actually somewhat different. I understood that you were basically wondering, well, I have a Higgs, what's going to happen now, right? Well, I mean, fundamentally, maybe the thing which I think is probably interesting to point out is that one of the facts of quantum mechanics, which also, of course, applies to quantum field theory, which the Standard Model is that a process is non-deterministic. That means if we have a Higgs, we can measure as much as we want about this Higgs. We don't know for the one particular instance what is going to happen. So if we do all of these experiments, what we have to do is we have to just generate a whole slew of them, and then we know in this percentage of the cases this particular thing is going to happen. And this follows exactly the rules of engagement with, well, the higher the mass, the more likely this particular process is. But I mean, the particular Higgs boson which has been produced, you cannot say before what's going to happen. And that's actually, in fact, for any of the collisions. This is why we have to take so much data and accumulate it, because, well, there's only a certain probability that something happens, which we're interested in. And therefore, well, we accumulate, and then we sift through the data and try to find the instances where what we want to observe is really happening.
God does play dice with atoms.
Yes. No. Well. Hi, guys. Just a quick one. Your descriptor has continuously been a Higgs-like boson throughout this discussion. Does this theory allow for an alternative at this stage? And what would be the ramifications if this was not actually a Higgs boson? Can you make any comments?
Can you repeat the question?
I'm not sure I can.
No, he asked when you refer to Higgs-like,
you've referred continuously to Higgs-like, and I can understand the early stages of this. Does theory allow at this stage for this to be an alternative? And if there was an alternative, what would be the ramifications for the theory?
Right. So the particle that we've discovered, to the best of our knowledge, couples in proportion to mass. That's what these measurements have shown. And the Higgs boson is something that couples proportional to mass, and that's why I very strongly believe that what we discovered is a Higgs boson. But there are other types of particles out there that might couple to mass, that do it in a kind of funny way, and we give them funny names. We call them dilatons or radions, or I don't know what else has appeared on the archive this morning, you know, crazy names for new particles that couple proportional to mass. And what they would imply that this crisis that I mentioned about quantum mechanical probabilities not adding up to 100%, that we would need to have some other mechanism to fix that problem. And there are scenarios, some scenarios that even myself I've worked on, where the Higgs could be, the things we've discovered could be something that's not a Higgs, and some other set of particles, a more complicated set of particles, could rescue quantum mechanics. But they seem kind of far-fetched now.
I actually wanted to add, a little bit of a personal perspective, and just kind of the Higgs imposter kind of possibility, I think will never really be completely ruled out. Meaning that we can with absolute certainty say this is the Higgs, the Standard Model Higgs, which we've been basically looking for to complete this model in a sense. So I think there's not a way of really absolutely excluding the possibility, even if we measure to a gnat's eyelash, as I like to say. So the question is then, it becomes like almost like a religious question, not really a scientific question anymore, where you say, well, what is it actually for you personally when you would feel comfortable to say, well, this is the Higgs boson? I mean, and we stop basically with the Higgs-like thing. So, I mean, for me personally, and I think that's, as I said, it's a religious view, and I think Marcus or Eddie, they might have different views on that. I will actually start to call it the Higgs when we have measured that the spin of the particle is zero. That means that we've shown it's a scalar particle, and with three standard deviations. But it is to some extent an arbitrary decision because, well, you can't absolutely rule it out.
Just one more thing to add is that I'm very happy to call this particle a Higgs boson. I'm not necessarily convinced that this is the only Higgs boson, and there are scenarios where you actually have more than just one Higgs boson, and some of the more exciting possibilities, which perhaps this strange deviations that we're seeing in the data may actually point to more than one of these funny objects. But I'd still call the one we have right now, I would still call it a Higgs boson.
Maybe one more question, I think. Is that about right?
Can you discuss what determines the strength with which a particle couples to the Higgs field, and why some particles couple whereas others don't?
If we understood that, we would understand one of the deepest mysteries of nature. So the way that I painted the picture here was that theoretical physics has one triumph after another triumph after another triumph. But there's this question there seems to be things in the standard model that didn't need to be there. We have the up and down quarks. They make us, we're built out of those. Our nuclei are built out of up and down quarks. But then we have these extra four, quarks which are just hanging around, the charm and the strange and the bottom and the top. They have wacko masses. What are they doing? What is their purpose there? And so there's extra junk in the standard model whose purpose we have not determined yet. And so if we could figure out where they actually got their mass from, that would help us point in the direction for why these fermions are hanging around.
Okay, do we want to keep going for another couple of questions? Are we getting tired? Oh, we have how about another couple and then we'll call it quits, okay? And I'm glad, Jesse, that you think you know the purpose of the up and down, but we don't know the purpose of the others. I really enjoyed that.
Can you talk about what's coming up in terms of experiments at the LHC and what role supersymmetry plays in any of this?
Upcoming experiments, what you said?
What are the things you're looking forward to at the LHC and kinds of results that you might be excited about? And what role does supersymmetry play in this?
So we are right now collecting more data. And so we can actually, in a quantitative way, answer your question. Currently, the precision in which we measure some of the parameters of the Higgs bosons are in the order of 20%. When we double the data, when we quadruple the data, this uncertainty goes down. So we can actually, with better precision, tell that this is the standard model Higgs boson or something else. And we have sensitivity to find deviations. So this is one of the major goals of the upcoming project. The LHC is going to shut down in 2013 and 14 in order to refurbish some of the magnets and be able to go to higher energy, almost all the way up to the design energies. By having more energies in the collisions, we are able to create heavier new particles, which might be of supersymmetric nature. And I give the next part of the question to Jesse.
So one of the things that we learned in particle physics was that every particle had an antiparticle, and this is a symmetry structure of the universe, which seems naively like it doubles everything. I mean, for every electron, you have a positron. For a proton, you have an antiproton. What did you do? You just doubled everything. But in fact, it was related to a symmetry of the universe. And supersymmetry, for every particle in the universe, there would be a cousin that would be exactly the same, except for it had the opposite spin, or opposite spin statistics. So every boson would have a fermion partner, and every fermion would have a boson partner. And there's any number of reasons to expect that supersymmetry is realized in nature. For example, supersymmetry allows for the unification of forces. Supersymmetry solves the deepest mysteries of exactly how the Higgs boson gives the right mass to itself. Supersymmetry is known to bring about world peace, so we're confident that something... Okay, maybe not. So discovering a new particle that might have a supersymmetric nature, that would tell us even more about the structure of our universe, and hopefully my colleagues will find evidence for something when they go to higher energy.
Do you think there's any legitimacy to the string theory approach, or is that just a really nice way of imagining things?
Are you
you're staying out. So I'm surprised no one complained about my putting gravity in the standard model.
Yeah,
Oh, you were? So gravity actually fits perfectly fine in the standard model as long as you're not doing collisions at very high energy. And LHC energies are perfectly fine for gravity coexisting with everything else. But if we had a really strong collider, we would actually get to the point where there'd be yet another crisis of quantum mechanics related to gravity itself, that gravitons could bounce off each other and give you the same going over 100%. And string theory is one of the best ideas we have for how to rescue quantum mechanics at extremely high energies. So it's energies beyond what the LHC is probing, but that possibility exists. String theory has actually turned out to be extremely useful, but not necessarily for fundamental physics. That string theory has turned out to be a great model for understanding other types of systems in nature, systems that you actually explore in tabletop experiments can actually be described using string theory. So even if string theory is not necessarily relevant for the discoveries at the LHC, it's having a renaissance in realizing that string theory as a construction, as a mathematical construction, might describe, you know, objects that you can hold in your hand.
Okay, I think we're going to call quits unless there's a really pressing question. Are we okay? Or you can just come and mill around if you wish for a few minutes with us. So thanks for your attention.